What's fantastic for me to see is when we go to our projects, like these really feel like they should be charitable activities. Like we're improving water quality, improving the local community. But meanwhile, Stripe, Shopify, and H&M are buying certificates from these projects to fuel them. So it really feels like this next leap in terms of like how we create change and create value for people at the same time.
What if the future of environmental restoration could fund itself? That's exactly what today's guests are proving. Welcome to Someone Like You, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm your host, Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and lover of bold, sustainable ideas. Luke and Colton of Carbon Run are transforming projects that feel like philanthropy, improving water quality, restoring ecosystems into scalable, profitable solutions. Backed by companies like Stripe, Shopify, and Google, they're not only fighting climate change, but they're reshaping how we think about business and impact. Today, we explore the science, resilience, and market innovation behind their journey. Get ready to be inspired.
And when we came into this scene, what we identified was that the market was 99.9% driven by tree planting credits or credits tied to emission reductions. And for us, like this felt like a pretty soft way for us to build credibility. Meanwhile, carbon removal or permanent carbon removal, if we want to talk about like duration of like more than 1,000 years, which is a label that I think Frontier would use in terms of what defines permanent versus less permanent solutions. That market has been growing exponentially. And that's where we find ourselves. And I think what we're hopeful on our side is that like while we've seen a contraction in the larger voluntary market, we are seeing huge growth in the demand for high quality carbon solutions.
Luke highlights a shift in the carbon market, moving beyond short-term solutions like tree planting credits to permanent carbon removal with measurable impact. Companies like Stripe and Shopify aren't just offsetting emissions, they're leading innovation in a market poised to grow exponentially. For sustainability builders, this is a reminder: long-term, scalable solutions are where the biggest opportunities lie.
And I would say team up. But what I find is the folks who reach out who are really struggling are the ones who are doing it alone and the ones who are sole founders trying to do all aspects of their business. And I think there's an instinct to like look at the potential dollar figure down the road and be like, that's the pie I want to go after. But I like as Colton said, there's so many things to focus on. And I think like try to find a partner. So it's like you have to sort of shoot your shot, go through the process and then move forward. And there's quiet periods in there that can be quite hard if you're on your own. I definitely wouldn't be here without Shannon, Eddie, and Colton. So I think like that's my piece of practical advice. Don't do it alone. Find the right team. And on that note, I think one thing that's really attractive about Carbon Run is like we look like a team that is like very determined and marching forward as a unit. And I think when people see us as a group, when we're at a conference or event, like there's something powerful around like a small group of people who are hyper mission oriented and like never underestimate, right? What a small determined group of people can do. So build that team and find those allies.
What Luke said about not going at it alone really resonates. So many founders try to tackle every aspect of their business themselves, but the real breakthroughs come from building the right team. For those of you working in sustainability, remember, aligning with the right partners who share your mission doesn't just make the journey less isolating, it also amplifies your impact, and studies show much more success comes out of it. Luke, Colton, welcome to the Someone Like You podcast. We have lots to discuss today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco. Looking forward.
Kind of want to set the stage. So you've raised close to $25 million. It's a team based on the East Coast of Canada in a market that is really, really growing, which is to basically how do we draw down a ton of carbon? And so we're going to kind of dive into a little bit of like the state of this market, the solution that you guys have been able to build, some kind of unique models around funding. You know, I'm an entrepreneur and CMO, so I'm just thinking like, wow, this is pretty incredible what you've been able to do. But before that, just to kind of set the next stage of this is, you know, Luke, can you describe a bit of your journey and what led you to co-founding Carbon Run?
Yeah, great question. So I'm based in Toronto, have been my whole life and found myself through the 2010s managing and running a small nonprofit that at the tail end of my time there gave me the opportunity to shift our focus from poverty relief and education to climate change. I think all of us in our own work, we're trying to find ways to make it relevant towards climate. And I think initially, like our work, we said, hopefully we're educating the next wave of climate scientists who solve the problem, but it just felt too far removed from addressing the actual root. And while it's fascinating because CDR is the opposite, carbon dioxide removal is the opposite of addressing the root, I found myself now, you know, with Colton and our team running what has quickly become, I think, one of the most promising carbon removal companies, not only in Canada, but globally. And so, yeah, how I got here was running this foundation. I read an article about enhanced rock weathering, which is one of these levers that scientists have identified as a way to potentially cool the planet. So while we stop burning gas and while we work on that, like it's now widely embraced that we also need to start removing excess carbon from the atmosphere. And again, one of these levers is this enhanced rock weathering pathways where, you know, as we look at the Rocky Mountains versus the Appalachians, really the only difference is time. And hopefully this is a visual that helps explain how the process works. And what's happened over millions of years is rain has slowly weathered down mountains and worn down rock into hills. And as that happens, as that rain weathers away those layers of rock, it's actually creating a chemical reaction where those rock molecules are bonding with atmospheric carbon and then entering rivers and streams and then going out to the ocean in a natural process that's been occurring for millions of years to, again, naturally cool the planet. And I read about this and I said, this is the one. This makes too much sense. It's so elegant. It has all these co-benefits. And I wrote the professor who had penned this journal article. And I said, hey, I'm Luke. I'm here in Toronto. This is 2020, July of 2020. And I'm like, hey, like, how can a small foundation like us support this research activity that you're positing and theorizing? And surprisingly, or maybe not, because I think, you know, maybe these profs don't get a lot of direct contact after they write an article. He wrote me back the same day and said, you know, if you're in Canada, I'm going to connect you with these two scientists in Nova Scotia who have been working to reduce acidification and reverse the impacts of acid rain, but doing it with enhanced rock weathering as a way to neutralize acid in the environment. And so July of 2020, I connected with Shannon and Eddie, who are based in Halifax. It was full blown COVID. So we talked online for 2 years. We didn't meet until we formed the company in 2022. But initially, our foundation just gave some small grants to Dalhousie, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, not hundreds of thousands, that enabled Shannon and Eddie to go out and to confirm that this process to deacidify rivers and boost salmon populations also had this fantastic benefit and of measurably and safely removing carbon from the atmosphere. So, you know, very much philanthropic effort at first. And then in 2022, all these crazy signals started to emerge calling for a new industry. And that new industry that big names and big thought leaders were calling for was the emergence of an industry of carbon dioxide removal. And that took a few forms. It took reports from groups like BCG and EY saying, you know, in order to avoid our worst climate goals, we need to remove carbon a couple billion tons per year by 2050. And if we're paying $100 a ton, like that's like a couple hundred billion dollars. Like they were painting the picture of what could become an industry. And I'm watching these and I'm just like, there's something powerful here, but like the cost to do it is too high. Like there's no market for people who are going to pay me or pay carbon run $400 per ton to do this. And I still remember a range of people who were like titans of industry, smart people coming to the hearing about what we're doing and essentially saying to us, this all sounds well and good, but like no one's going to pay you that. And I'll basically eat my shorts if you guys can sell carbon credits for $400 per ton. And as we're like at this moment, Frontier Climate comes out of nowhere. And for those who don't know who Frontier Climate is, Frontier Climate is a buyer's group led by Stripe of market leading companies, world leading companies, you know, S&P companies who all together pledged $1 billion to pay for high quality carbon removal. And the moment that this all started to make sense is they said, we will buy carbon removal that can do all the things that we knew our pathway could do. It has to be permanent. It has to have co-benefits. It has to be verifiable. And then the crowning touch to this is that they would pay anything to get that product. And so we formed a company to go after this opportunity. And as you mentioned, where we are now is we now have over $26 million in demand for our carbon removals from leading companies like Stripe, Shopify, Google, British Airways, and a whole whack of others. And it's been fantastic to watch what really felt like a philanthropic activity turn into something that could potentially be the next big thing. Yeah. And then fortunately along that way, you know, a nonprofit executive like me who didn't know how to raise a dollar or pitch a deck got lucky to reconnect with Colton and really started to breathe life into what the business model looked like and how to attract investors and buyers to the opportunity.
Yeah. And Colton, to bring you into the fold, your previous work and how it's kind of shaped you with what you're doing at Carbon Run. Can you kind of give us a bit of that connection as well?
Yeah. It's one of those histories in the past that kind of didn't know where it was taking me until I found myself here in many ways. My background is in health and sustainability. So that part is more of a natural fit, but I've been working in media and tech and various media platforms for last 20 years. Or so. And so I cut my teeth in WebMD in my 20s and was there about a decade growing, really in charge of the business development and the growth of the company, and it, particularly outside of pharma, and always was looking at the sustainability angle and the health aspects of the WebMD, of what we could provide, you know, our users. And at that point, I realized I was, you know, my passion and interest in the sustainability side was much stronger. So I left WebMD in about 2007 with a couple other WebMD colleagues and founded a sustainability platform called EcoMe. And this was really to help people make sustainable choices. So mostly from an environmental aspect, but also from a health and economic standpoint. And evolved that and grew that and you can speak more about that. But what I think I found is what are these key levers that help grow both an audience as well as from a buyer standpoint, who's going to be, in this case, sponsoring the platform, or in Carbon Run's standpoint, buying the credits. So that's what, you know, when I kind of fast forward till today, it was about 2022 when I met Luke and Eddie and Shannon. And what Carbon Run built, like, it immediately resonated with me. It's just that they have this platform with like a tangible, measurable impact and quantifiable with a carbon removal, which working in the media space, you know, we had millions of people come to EcoMe on a given month, but it was a little bit unknown what people were doing with that information. The world wasn't as evolved as it is now in that space. And so with the carbon removal in the river alkalinity, with what Carbon Run is doing, it was, you know, it was really exciting to be able to dig in. And I think on the flip side, on the economic standpoint, I have an economics background, and working in rivers was one of these really kind of untapped, exciting. So beyond the ecological benefits, you know, it's no one was doing anything in rivers with the carbon dioxide removal, you know, and I think because they're deceivingly powerful. They have about half of a percentage of the Earth's surface, but most of the world's fresh water flows through them at one point. Right. So it makes for this really unbelievable resource that we can both restore, but also work with them to where they can help us, you know, remove that carbon out into the estuaries and the oceans.
And I really, you know, love the two connecting stories, especially the fact that this is kind of all connected through two scientific research projects, or two scientific co-founders, really, that brought this idea. And then the two of you being able to bring this kind of to life on the business side, which is really fascinating. And so just to like understand this kind of root market opportunity, my understanding is, I think it was the IPCC report maybe a couple of years ago, said to hit our kind of goals, we need to start sucking carbon out of the atmosphere, and we need to be investing into this space. And that was kind of maybe that big opportunity on the market. But before that, we kind of all thought about just like trees, right? You know, we plant a trillion trees and we're going to save the world. We all know that that's not really the case. But the simple idea is that, you know, you don't cut down trees, trees store carbon, and yay, we're good. And that kind of opened up this opportunity to remove carbon. And that also sets the market for like planting a tree. It's like, you know, it's going to be a dollar per ton, to all the way of like, you know, using a fan to suck carbon out of the atmosphere and store it into the ground, and we're going to charge $1,000 to do that. There's this massive spectrum, but I would just love to just understand where you guys are thinking about, obviously, this market. What's the demand like? What's the supply like? Like, this seems like just an absolutely massive opportunity for people to do good, but also to get to this root cause where we're trying to suck all this carbon out of the atmosphere. So where that market looks like right now. Before Luke gets into this, let's just take a moment to understand why the carbon market is evolving. For decades, the market relied on solutions like tree planting credits or emission reductions, which often lacked permanence. But the urgency of the climate crisis demands more. Companies now want solutions that can store carbon for centuries, which now has created a growing market for innovative approaches like Carbon Runs. Let's hear Luke explain how this shift is transforming the industry.
So where do we fit? I think it's a fascinating thing to look at in the sense that we're like carbon dioxide removal as a form of decarbonization is a niche within a niche within a niche. And what I mean by that is in order for us to meet our climate goals, number one, the first thing we have to do is stop burning oil and gas. Number two, if we can't do that, is to offset it with or carbon credits of some form. And when we came into this scene, what we identified was that the market was 99.9% driven by tree planting credits or credits tied to emission reductions. And emission reductions credits can be everything from Tesla, who generated $400 million in revenue by convincing regulators that their electric cars led to an emission reductions that would be created by gas burning cars, to companies that have sold and distributed what they would claim are more efficient charcoal stoves that in developing countries emit less CO2 than their prior versions. And for us, like, this felt like a pretty soft way for us to build credibility. And I think we've seen that in the sense that in 2023, the voluntary carbon market, which is companies that are not obligated to buy carbon removal or their offsets, but are simply doing it because they want to do the right thing, it went from $2 billion in total revenue in 2023. And then following a series of credibility breaking news articles and stories, it went to $500 million in 2024. Oh. So we saw a cratering of like traditional credits. And we've seen a number of registries that, you know, specialize in tree planting credits close their doors because their volume plummeted significantly. And a number of these companies have also had to sell off their land parcels because there's no market for those tree planting credits. Meanwhile, carbon removal or permanent carbon removal, if we want to talk about like duration of like more than 1,000 years, which is a label that I think Frontier would use in terms of what defines permanent versus less permanent solutions, that market has been growing exponentially. And that's where we find ourselves. And so it seems pretty fragmented, and it is. And I think what we're hopeful on our side is that like while we've seen a contraction in the larger voluntary market, we are seeing huge growth in the demand for high quality carbon solutions. And I think there is this thought coming online in terms of we can't just kick the can down the road 20, 30, 40 years by planting a tree or burning less fuel or doing it more efficiently. Like we need to put this somewhere permanently. And I think what's really cool, if we pull even further out, like the earth has two ways to naturally cool itself. One is trees, and then two is this weathering process that I outlined of rock weathering off and carrying carbon to the ocean. These two things are happening naturally. And I think the only difference is you can't look out your window and look at the weathering process the way you can look at a tree. But very much that same thing's happening where carbon's accumulating on the land, entering rivers, which are very much the trunk of a tree, and then going through that trunk down into the roots, which are the ocean, where it's supposed to be kept permanently. So I think like what we're excited about is that even though we look quite different on paper from the traditional credits, the fact that we're using this natural process makes it a bit more tangible and approachable than a few of the other engineered solutions that are quickly gaining traction, like direct air capture or biochar.
When we think about nature-based solutions, we usually think of trees, but there's another powerful process at work. Rock weathering is a natural phenomenon where minerals bond with carbon in the atmosphere and safely store it in the ocean for thousands of years. This is one of the processes Carbon Run is harnessing, and as Luke explains, it's a game changer for scaling long-term carbon removal.
Yeah, and it seems connected to the permanence, which you kind of outlined as well. And you mentioned something that I think a lot of people kind of get confused around the market with Tesla, because ultimately what Tesla is doing is it's selling the benefit that the consumer is having to the environment by going to an electric vehicle and then selling that to companies that need to potentially offset their carbon emissions. Like this is that kind of a core idea and core issue that a lot of people kind of don't understand. Is that how you see that Tesla thing that they're doing?
Exactly. And I think like it's brilliant in the fact that Tesla has been able to convince regulators in California, which is, I believe, the market that Tesla transacts most of their credits. They convinced them that this was a viable solution for companies that can't meet their climate objectives themselves. And I think it speaks to the lack of variety and options consumers have had in the past decade or two. Like it's really been limited to tree planting or emission reductions type schemes where you're showing that this creates less emissions and therefore we can package it and sell it to you to like offset yours. And I think like on that note, like when we first started this journey, like there was no methodology. And when we looked at those registries and marketplaces where you could buy a carbon credit, it was literally 100% emission reduction or tree planting protocols. And so the fact that we've, you know, gone from this static situation for 15, 20 years, where that's all you could buy, to now this like moment of innovation and new product that like, it's pretty amazing. And we don't know what to think or say about Elon Musk. He's a huge proponent of CDR. And the, for those who are familiar with the XPRIZE, you know, there's a $100 million prize out right now. You know, 20 different CDR companies are vying for it to pull these technologies forward, you know, because there is such a need. And it's become, I guess, more and more obvious as it's gone on this journey.
And just to pull on the Tesla thread a bit is, you know, if you look at what Elon built initially with the cars, it had a stand on its own as a vehicle that consumers would want to buy regardless if it was electric or not, right? It had to be one of the best vehicles out there on the road, standalone. And then the electric was just a nice to have, if you will. I'd say this very similar thing as far as carbon removal, in that the quality has to be, it's going to prevail, the quality carbon removal. It's, and this is case of all new markets with the tech and the media market. When different, you know, websites came out, ultimately the content was the king. You know, the best solutions were always kind of rise to the top. And I think with carbon removal, there's a place for various types of solutions, ones for shorter durability. And as far as, you know, the duration of the carbon credit. But, you know, ultimately is that the buyers, and this is also protect themselves. It's one, to do the right thing, but two, to be associated with long-term, durable, credible credits are going to be looking for these solutions that have, you know, 1,000 years associated with the carbon removal. And I think in Carbonite's case, where it's, the other thing that was very exciting is that, you know, you look at this, the carbon removal in many ways is the side benefit. Like the core benefit what we're doing is this, the river restoration piece, improving that water quality that's been damaged by pollution. It's boosting the fish populations, increasing that productivity of the fish stocks, increasing the biodiversity. These are the, these core benefits. And so, you know, and that's where, you know, looping it back to the Tesla analogy is that these are all benefits that stand on their own. And that carbon removal is just this, you know, wonderful side benefit that also allow us to pay for this.
Yeah. And that was kind of where I was going to go with is two questions is like, obviously you partnered with two scientific co-founders, you have some research, but, you know, obviously putting limestone into rivers must hit some sort of regulatory hurdles right away. And then like, how did you fund that initial testing phase? Because what you mentioned earlier was that you have this demand-led funding, which is a really kind of unique term. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But to get this kind of testing, was it just through philanthropy and grants initially? Like, how do you kind of get through the regulatory side of putting stuff into the rivers? And then like, where does that hurdle look like? And how did you fund it along the way? What makes Frontier Climate's role so crucial is that they're not just funders, they're validators. For any new company in sustainability, gaining that stamp of approval is what unlocks trust, partnerships, and scaling opportunities. Their commitment to vetting high-quality solutions like Carbon Runs sets the standards for the entire industry, and it's an example of how collaboration accelerates innovation.
That's a great question. And like, I'll start at the end and then go back. There was a moment like last summer, like this 2023, summer of 2023, where like we had literally put all of our eggs in the basket of Frontier to validate us as a viable CDR pathway. And I say that because Frontier was the only group who had the diligence team who could review a new methodology and put a stamp on it that the rest of the world could be comfortable moving ahead with. And honestly, it felt like the movie Field of Dreams, where like, I'm Kevin Costner, like we're all Kevin Costner, I guess, in this, and we're all raking the infield and like the bank's coming tomorrow to take the property. And like, we're like, they need to show up. Like if they don't show up, like this has been a great journey, but like we didn't satisfy the customer, you know, which is like ultimately what we need to do. So I say that and like, and I think that like, hopefully that speaks to your listeners where it's like, things look great now, but it's been scary throughout the journey to get here. And there's been many moments we didn't know whether we'd get to the other side. So like, just keep going.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's unfortunate it's a podcast because Luke's also has Kevin Costner looks and swagger as well, but no one can see that. But Luke's right in that really was, it aligned in so many ways with what Frontier's advanced market commitment was looking for and for solutions. And I remember meeting with Luke early on and he spoke about Frontier. So this is, I worry we're maybe even too late because there, you know, I think the challenge space is not, there's strong demand signals, but there's not a plethora of them. There's not, you know, you've got Frontier, Microsoft, a handful of large buyers. And at that time, there wasn't as many smaller ones. And so the timing for so many of these things is, it's got to be right. That being said, I'd say we're really starting to see a lot more smaller buyers and interested parties come to the table that are recognizing that look, what they can do is actually material. And it might not be in volume, but there might be other ways that they're contributing. And that's also been really exciting and heartening to see that it doesn't have to be these $25 million buys to kind of move that needle.
Yeah, and Marco, to go back to the first half of that question, thank you, Trick Colton, you brought me back around. I think that while it looks like we're like an overnight success, you're going to hate me because I paraphrase movies all the time, but you know, the founder movie about McDonald's, like the Kroc brothers, or like not the Kroc, Ray Kroc's talking to the two brothers and he says, what's going on here? Like, how'd you guys figure this out? It's beautiful. And he's like, we're an overnight success that's 20 years in the making. And what I mean by that is Shannon and Eddie were working on this 2005, I believe. And they didn't know they were working on a climate solution at the time. I think this is also what's quite beautiful, is that they spent their careers trying to reverse the impacts of acid rain and improve water quality. And as Colton got to, lo and behold, as the world started to realize we needed solutions to remove carbon from the atmosphere and like the science started to take hold, they'd already proven that this process is safe. They've proven that it triples the number of fish in the rivers that we do alkalinity enhancement in. And that makes it a lot easier for us to move fast now in the face of other technologies that have come out of thin air in the last 2 to 3 years. So I think there's a history that we have. There's a history of river liming that goes back 60 years in Scandinavia that we're constantly reminding our partners of, in terms of this is a safe restoration practice first and a carbon removal global solution second. And I think what's fantastic for me to see is when we go to our projects, like these really feel like they should be charitable activities. Like we're improving water quality, improving the local community. But meanwhile, Stripe, Shopify, and H&M are buying certificates from these projects to fuel them. So it really feels like this next leap in terms of like how we create change and create value for people at the same time that's been missing.
This is such a great example of how sustainability and profitability can align. Carbon Run's projects, restoring rivers, improving biodiversity, sound like traditional nonprofit activities. But by creating measurable carbon removal credits, they built a model that's scalable, self-sustaining, and attractive to major companies. For anyone in this space, it's a reminder to think creatively about how to fund impactful work. And do you think that without Frontier, you could have been able to take this to market? I know, Colton, you mentioned that there's definitely some smaller buyers and you're now starting to see that. But without this kind of demand-led funding and Frontier being able to solidify this opportunity as a carbon removal option, do you think, you know, you would have ran into, found another funding model, or do you think that the market yet is there for this?
I think it would have been really challenging, is what I think. And, you know, what a world looks like with Frontier, there might have been components of it, right? So Stripe led and initiated Frontier and brought in Shopify, Stripe, McKinsey. But what they might have done on their own, right, might have been meaningful. And or I'm sure it would have been meaningful, but it's really the collective force, feel that, and the trust, and being able to create a scientific body that was able to say, I'm not just, it's not just scientific, but also, you know, they had financial and other experts that part of the team that are looking at not just the quality of the solution, but saying, is this a solution that can scale? And is a solution that can scale efficiently, you know, to $100 or sub $100 per ton of carbon removal. And that, right? So having that body working on behalf of all these buyers allowed them to kind of really sift through and sort what solutions are going to be, you know, kind of really beneficial today, but more importantly, what can scale tomorrow that they can be a part of. And, you know, I look at what they do, it's altruistic, but it's also self-serving in a good way, and that they want to be associated and have the ability to buy from these platforms in 5, 10, 20 years. I mean, ultimately, hopefully this isn't needed after that, the carbon removal, but, you know, I think that's what they're aligning with. And so, yeah, back to your question, it certainly would have been a different place. Don't know where it would have been, Luke.
No, and I'll just add to that. Like when we had, we've gone through a couple rounds of diligence with Frontier, I don't think we're alone. Like we sit across the table from them and we're like, we are here as Carbon Run because of Frontier. Like I think just to go back into more granular thinking, like before Frontier emerged, like me as a nonprofit exec and Shannon and Eddie as two academics, like the grand vision I had sold them was like, we're going to go out, we're going to go talk to donors and the government, we're going to raise $50 to $100 million. We'll create the River Alkalinity Enhancement of Excellence at Dalhousie University. And that's how we'll like hopefully show the world how to do this and governments will pay for it. And so like that vision was like interesting and everything, but it's like, we'd still be trying to get like the first 10 million in the door to like fund the institute. Whereas like we found a shortcut with like consumer demand. And I think they knew it. And I think to back it up, like Frontier is based off this philanthropic model that was initially used to advance the development of childhood pneumonia vaccine. In the early 2000s, the UN Gates Foundation, a few other donors said, we can't get these pharmaceutical companies to get off their butts and do the right thing. So let's be the customer for them and give them what they need, which is money that their shareholders will approve the action for to get them to move faster. So it was a recognition that like we can't just like talk the talk and say we're doing the right thing. We actually have to create market mechanisms to drive people to make these things. And I think the challenge here is there weren't a ton of pharmaceutical companies that Frontier could go to say like, hey, switch, like make this new medicine. They literally spawned a whole industry. And so when I think about like the Carbon Run book 20 years from now, now it's a pamphlet. One day it will be a book. It starts out probably with like, thank you to Frontier. Like without you guys, like we don't exist. So I give them huge credit because they're out on a limb. Like they get as much shit, pardon my French, they get as much for what they're doing as positive attention. And I think that like when we look back in 20 years, like we'll see this intervention as something that's being critical, the scaling up of carbon removal technologies.
It'd be interesting to say too that Frontier with Stripe and a bunch of other large tech companies as well, as tech companies tend to be pretty opportunistic. They are typically trying to lead when it comes to new innovations, especially with climate. They want to work towards a future that is cleaner and brighter for everybody. But also at the same time, AI is growing astronomically fast and these tech companies are starting to realize, I think it was Google last year or this year, is they're anticipating a 40% increase in energy consumption due to AI. Is that fueling any of this as well from Frontier's perspective?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say from Frontier's perspective so much as their cohort, right? That the companies that are part of Frontier. So take Google or Alphabet rather, and some of the other tech companies. I think that's absolutely driving them. And that's driven from their own employees that are part of it and recognize this. This comes to people in the industry. And it comes to, you know, meaning those that are using AI and Google. It's just, it is becoming much more relevant and topical in the news. And then you have third-party platforms. I mean, I came from the media space that mentioned, and there's a company that spun out of that called Scope 3. And what they're doing is they're tracking digital advertising across online and what the Scope 3 emissions are of that. And, you know, trying to do two things. One, both reduce the amount of server and load and the cost, but also then what you can't remove, try to enable smart purchasing of carbon removal for that. So I think, you know, when I look back and I started a company called EcoMe, the sustainability site in 2007, what was missing is this ecosystem to be able to take that information that we're informing consumers and other, you know, audience members about. What was missing was that, what do you do with that information? How do you act on that? And that's these missing links. So as much as AI is taxing the ecosystem, it's also providing and enabling people to, you know, these tools and the resources to be able to actually be aware of what their individual footprint is, what the options are of what you can do, and potentially purchase that. And so from Frontier's perspective, I think it's an aspect, a component of it, but we're seeing that actually bubble up elsewhere and other avenues.
So to talk about scale, obviously we've, you know, you talked about the benefits that your Carbon Run has to the river in terms of fish population, as well as the solution as a carbon removal credit. And so like, obviously all the data points are really, really great. We have lots of problems. I'm a fly fisherman, so I'm very excited for your solution. But how do you, I guess, scale this? Was this like Frontier, this $25, $26 million, is this for one river or is this for like multiple rivers? And like, what's the next kind of 3 to 5 years like? And I'll add one more question, because my understanding is scale and price is important. Like, does the market need to be at $150 per ton to be really, really scalable into the future? And that's when this really unlocks this massive kind of growth in carbon removal opportunities? It's a long-winded big question, but how does this all scale? When we think of carbon removal, we often picture forests or high-tech machinery, but rivers are one of the most powerful and underutilized resources we have. These ecosystems move massive amounts of water and carbon naturally, yet they're often overlooked in discussions about climate solutions. As Luke explains, this untapped potential is central to Carbon Run's approach and is something we all need to understand.
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, a bunch of folks are framing the need. I think they're trying to do two things, is weigh that the world's willingness to pay versus the global need. It's like a balance, because we can't, like, we can't have 100% of GDP in 2050 go towards like carbon removal, right? Like it needs to fit within like this model. And so Frontier frame it in a way that I think is quite concise, which is, you know, if we need 5 gigatons, so 5 billion tons of carbon removal,
$100 a ton.
By 20, at $100 a ton, that's $500 billion. And if we expect global GDP to be $100 trillion by 2050, we're looking to impose like a 0.5% tax. And here's the question, like, who pays for that CDR? Because like, it's a global benefit. And like, it's like, who's responsible? It's hard to tell. It's like, who, we don't know what that looks like. But that's, I think, what it looks like at scale in terms of an industry size and like where it fits into like our global spend. spend. And to me, it's an insurance policy that enables that GDP to continue growing. We're like an insurance policy against rapid change to our climate and making it harder to grow the pie. So I think like that's the high end. I think, you know, we hear that $100 a ton number be thrown around a lot. I don't think anyone knows quite how we got there, other than that it feels kind of right. And that for a buyer, when they, I think when polluters have been asked, like, you know, what's your ceiling in terms of what you'd pay for a ton of removal? Like everyone sort of settles around that $100. And I think it's a bit of a hard to determine where that came from. In terms for us, I think, you know, when we've done sensitivity analysis on our price per ton, there is no scenario where river alkalinity enhancement at scale cannot deliver under $100 per ton. And the reason for that is, you know, simple mass balance work to get there. And what I mean by that is where product in equals product out. There's no alchemy. We can determine what the price of a ton of limestone is, which is what we add to a river to deacidify it and draw down carbon. And we can add up all the costs to apply it, measure it, and bring it to market. And when we do that, even in the worst case scenario of high prices and low-sized rivers, we're able to achieve $100 per ton. The last thing I'll add on scale is that rivers offer a fantastic place to scale this. And we certainly could deliver all 55,000 tons of the frontier offtake from one river. Right now, we're developing a few projects on a handful of rivers to not only spread the opportunity, but to de-risk potential project slowdowns on one site. And there are six orders of magnitude of rivers, as Shannon, my co-founder, would remind us. Meaning, you know, we go from a river that's putting out 1 cubic yard of water per second past a point to rivers that are putting out 1 million cubic yards of water per minute past a certain point. So that's our vision in terms of we can start on the 1 cubic yard river to prove this process, do it at pilot scale. But, you know, we can get into those large rivers like the Amazon, the Hudson, the Mackenzie as we develop the MRV and the application process.
And how important is profit in all of this as well as you start to build a business? And we'll share some links in the footnotes and everything to see what Carbon Run solution looks like. But it kind of looks like a big silo on the side of the river. It's not very obtrusive at all. And so how important is profit to, you know, this next stage of your business? Cost is one of the biggest barriers to scaling carbon removal. Right now, many solutions are expensive, making them hard to adopt at scale. But the goal is to get to $100 per ton, a price point that makes carbon removal accessible for governments, corporations, and even smaller organizations. Let's listen as Luke breaks down how Carbon Run is working towards this critical target and why it's so important for the industry.
It's important. You know, I think there's any solution out there would say the same thing. It's got to go hand in hand. The scaling opportunity for removal, it's got to go with profitability. And it's not just for Carbon Run's sake, right? This is for all the stakeholders that we're working with. This is for, first of all, with that profit, we can bring in, you think about all the different various local stakeholders that are working on that projects, from the delivery of the limestone to maintenance, you know, so you have the hyper-local jobs, you have the, you know, the project developers that we're working with. You know, this is something that it hits various parties. And I think they're all, the profitability aspect is something that we're sharing across, you know, across the table. And so, you know, I think that it only will continue to scale is if it works within an ecosystem organically.
And I'll just add to that, Colton, I think that what we've learned is that customers are happy to pay a high price as long as they're getting what they're looking for in the early days of this industry. And what that looks like on our model is it looks probably a lot like what a defense company would look like in terms of, you know, our model is a cost plus margin model. We're not creating, you know, multiples on our profit margin. We're talking 10 to 20%, which is what the defense industry is allowed to charge because we need what we need to get, but we can't charge crazy profits to get what we need to get if it's expensive product. So I think like that's what we look and feel like. It's like we need to be transparent with our costs. We need to show the world how like it's high cost now, but here's the path to low cost. And so I think, again, as Colton hinted to you earlier, like the more important thing for our customers right now are the right of first opportunity and the opportunity to buy more supply at lower costs in the future. The opportunity to make massive fortunes through profit are down the road in this industry. Fortunately, we have customers who are willing to pay the cost of production today. And that's what let us start Carbon Run. I think yeah. You know, otherwise we would forced into a nonprofit model.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Luke. I think that transparency of the cost is what's driving innovative solutions. Like right now, it's like you look at Costco and I think they capped their profits at what, 12%. And so it forces their suppliers to be creative and it's like what they want to come to the table with. In our case, you know, it's very transparent what the alkaline materials cost, right? What the cost of limestone is, what the cost of transport is. And so we can work with those limestone providers. We can work with the transport to come up with creative solutions to remove that and be able to either share in the profit or have another structure. But that transparency just makes it easier to work with the ecosystem.
I think people need to understand that are listening too, how unique the funding model is that you have gone from Frontier, from like a forward investment in like, we are going to fund this much based off of this type of price point for this many tons. And it's quite a unique model. And to have that kind of assurance that you know that you can build this into this type of funding is really, really interesting and kind of unique, and loved kind of seeing it. So as we kind of just wind down, just a bit of advice, like, you know, entrepreneurs, innovators are trying to make a positive impact on the environment, and you are doing it from both an impact to our rivers, an impact to be able to remove carbon, but you're also building a business too. So, you know, what advice would you say to these type of innovators?
I would say, don't worry about trying to solve everything at once. There's a lot of ways of combating the climate change. And, you know, even what we're doing, it's like there feels like moving mountains, but, you know, 90% is actually about the reduction. So we're all in this together. We got to throw everything at the solution at this point and see what we can do. And so just for everyone to think about that component, what they can really do well, do it right. And then I think it'll organically make its way into the ecosystem if it's done well.
That's a great piece of advice. And I would say team up. I have unfortunately like now become someone that founders are like, hey, Luke, how did you do this? How did you get to this place, right? And it's like, don't ask me, first of all. It's like, oh, God. But what I find is the folks who reach out who are really struggling are the ones who are doing it alone, and the ones who are sole founders trying to do all aspects of their business. And I think there's an instinct to like look at the potential dollar figure down the road and be like, that's the pie I want to go after. But I, like as Colton said, there's so many things to focus on. And I think like try to find a partner, try to find a friend. It can be a lonely period just with the lack of people to go to. And so there aren't 100 frontiers. So it's like you have to sort of shoot your shot, go through the process, and then move forward. And there's quiet periods in there that can be quite hard if you're on your own. So I think there's a lot of cool companies I've met who, you know, have started with a co-founder. A lot of companies I've met actually a Gaia Refinery, which is a really cool Halifax-based direct air capture company. Those two founders met at a founder speed dating event, right? So I think like I see when that happens, like each of those people independently at Gaia may not have gotten here. I definitely wouldn't be here without Shannon, Eddie, and Colton. So I think like that's my piece of practical advice. Don't do it alone. Find the right team. And on that note, I think one thing that's really attractive about Carbon Run is like we look like a team that is like very determined and marching forward as a unit. And I think when people see us as a group, when we're at a conference or events, like there's something powerful around like a small group of people who are hyper mission oriented, and like never underestimate, right, what a small determined group of people can do. So build that team and find those allies.
Luke's advice about finding the right team is spot on. For founders in sustainability, the work is complex and no one person can do it all. The most successful businesses I've seen are built by mission-driven teams with complementary skills, and they share a vision. If you're just starting out, invest in time finding the right people. It can make all the difference. Luke, Colton, that was a really fun conversation. And I think one of the things from your founding story was that you just reached out. You took this opportunity to reach out to two scientists that were doing something pretty meaningful and said, I think we can do something here, which is really fascinating. And I think a lot of people, when you think about climate or climate tech, are like, but I'm not technical or I'm not scientific, but you know, I can bring my kind of business sense or my experiences to it. So how important is that? And can you share a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I think it's important to follow your instincts. And Marco, it's been great to be on this podcast and rehash some of the stories. And as we're moving so fast, think about it. I think, you know, what we found is like the truer we are to ourselves and the weirder we are, the more the customers want what we're making. And I think in a world where we're on the fifth iteration of business model, this is pretty fresh, right? And I think the world is looking for fresh ideas. So now is the time to jump in, because like now is when all the weirdos like me can actually have an impact before it becomes highly professionalized and standardized. So I think it's not often every 20, 30 years when an industry emerges like this, that's hopeful and optimistic, and yeah, jump in.
Learn enough to engage. And then you can take that, you can really be that translator at that point to the rest of the market. Everyone's going to have certain limitations outside. So if they're coming from the financial side, or if they're coming from the tech side, lean in. If you feel like there's something there, lean in, learn about it, and then apply what you can apply.
That wraps up today's episode of Someone Like You. A big thank you to Luke Connell and Colton Dirksen for sharing their incredible journey with us. Their work at Carbon Run reminds us that solving the climate crisis isn't just about bold ideas, it's about building systems that scale and bring measurable impact.
If today's conversation inspired you, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with others who are ready to challenge the old rule of business to build something better. For more updates and insights, follow us on social media. Thank you again for listening, and until next time, keep breaking the rules strategically and building a better future.